Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Plague, a Very Short Introduction, by Paul Slack. Narrated by Gareth Richards. Publisher's note: in this audio edition, you will hear references to figures present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Introduction. Anyone interested in the past knows something about plague. About the Black Death, perhaps, or the Great Plague of London, the global pandemic of coronavirus in 2019 through 2020 has generated fresh interest in epidemic disasters of that kind, and what they have to tell us about how people responded to them. This little book is designed for those who want to know more, and as a brief introduction to what is now a very large, scholarly, and popular literature accumulated around plague, much of it questioning the identity, causes, and effects of past epidemic disasters. My approach is that of a historian, interested in understanding the impact of great epidemic diseases in the past and the ways in which they have been interpreted. The conclusions and speculations arising from modern medical and environmental science will have a place chiefly in chapters 1 through 3, since they may help to explain the incidents and effects of plague in the past, while forming a part of its cultural impact in the present. But I have also tried, in chapters 4 through 6, to explain what plague meant for those who suffered from it in earlier centuries, for the governments and public authorities who set out to fight it, and for the authors, past and present, who have written about it. The history of plague, like that of many other epidemic diseases, is full of unexpected twists and turns, and its course is often as difficult to explain today, with all the benefits of medical hindsight, as it was for people who experienced it then. That is part of the subject's perennial fascination. But its interest also lies in the ways in which people coped with sudden death and disease in earlier centuries, and how they somehow came to terms with them. The book is arranged by themes, rather than as a straightforward chronology. But I hope that it shows the important continuities in the story, which can be observed over time. My aim has been to look at past pandemics of plague from a variety of standpoints. And in my final chapter 7, on The Lessons of Histories, to bring out what we may still have to learn from them. Oxford, August 2020. Chapter 1. Plague. What's in a name? Names are always important because they create identities. They are particularly important when it comes to diseases, where a name, a diagnosis, carries with it some reassurance that the phenomenon is known and understood. It may nowadays indicate its characteristic symptoms, as with AIDS, or the pathogen responsible for them, as with HIV, and so offer some prospect of treatment and perhaps cure. The names of diseases, and especially those of epidemic diseases, often have very long histories, however. They have sometimes been applied to past illnesses with symptoms which modern medical science has shown to be caused by more than one biological agent. Leprosy and the Great Pox are examples. The identity of plague is a classic case of uncertainty of this kind. It is susceptible to a variety of interpretations, and its identity has been the subject of much dispute. In its Greek and Latin origin, plague meant a blow, something sudden and acute, and in general parlance it has often been employed as a generic term, applicable to almost any calamity, and to pests like locusts, as well as to human and animal diseases of many kinds. The sense in which it is used in this book, and in many larger works on which this one draws, is more precise, though still sometimes contentious. Plague is the word that has been used over the centuries to denote an epidemic disease of particular severity and dramatic impact, a disease which probably always had the same causative agent, now known to have been a bacillus, Yersinia pestis. Across most of its recorded history, plague has been distinguished from other epidemic diseases in two ways. First, it killed more people more quickly. In major outbreaks in European cities between the 14th and 17th centuries, it was not unusual for one quarter of the population to die within a year, and it is likely that just as many more might have been infected and then have recovered. In terms of mortality and morbidity, plague's only rivals may be the smallpox which Europeans took to the Americas after 1492, and the worldwide Spanish flu of 1918-19. Each of those disasters was undoubtedly of great historical significance, but neither has left the long-written record of recurrent epidemics that allows the history of plague to be written. The second distinguishing feature of plague, evident from the long series of records, lies in the special horrors which it inflicted on its victims, and which threatened all those around them. The more elaborate descriptions, most of them surviving from the 14th century onwards, commonly refer to the extreme delirium, fever, and painful tumours of the sick, and to the putrid matter issuing from their sores, mouths, and nostrils, which could contaminate anyone nearby. "The breath is so stinking," one French physician recorded in 1666, "that it is virtually intolerable." Thus the common proverb in French is true: one smells of plague. Easily sensed and identified, polluting whole cities, that cause of private suffering and collective disaster has, since at least the 6th century AD, been given the same name, plague or pestilence, pestis in Latin, and sometimes the plague or the pestilence. This book will focus on the history of the disease in major epidemic form, so far as that is known, and in periods when its ravages were most pronounced, down to the first decades of the 20th century. Since the 1920s, partly thanks to public health measures and modern antibiotics, plague has been less serious as a human affliction, but it has not disappeared. It persists among animals in many parts of the world, though not in Europe, and flares up occasionally in isolated epidemics, minor in comparison with those of the past. Since 1990, however, the number of human cases has been rising. Between 1,000 and 5,000 are being reported annually to the World Health Organization, many of them in parts of Africa and Asia, where there had been none for several decades. And plague is now classified as a re-emerging disease. In its late 20th century manifestations, plague is certainly much better understood than it has ever been. Since the 1940s, it has been the subject of extensive research, prompted in part by the possibility of its use in biological warfare or terrorism. And there are now many scientific papers and statistical studies about its prevalence, its animal reservoirs and carriers, and its clinical impact on human beings. The findings of modern medical science about plague's causes, its etiology, and its incidence in distribution, its epidemiology, have illuminated many aspects of its history, but they have not removed all the uncertainties surrounding it. On the contrary, they have given rise to considerable debate about whether all the plagues of the past can have had the same cause as those of the present. Plague or not? The scientific techniques of pathology, bacteriology, and epidemiology, developed by investigators of cholera and other epidemic diseases in the 19th century, were first applied to plague when it suddenly erupted in the cities of China and India in the 1890s. The organism was first isolated in 1894, almost simultaneously by Shibasaburo Kitasato, a Japanese pupil of Robert Koch, and Alexandre Yersin, a Swiss pupil of Pasteur, both of them working in Hong Kong. It was a bacillus then known as Pasteurella pestis, and now called Yersinia pestis in Yersin's honour. From then onward, plague was a specific entity, biologically distinguishable from diseases with other causes. Yersin showed, further, that rats were carriers of the disease, and in 1898, Paul-Louis Simond demonstrated that plague was transmitted from rodents to humans by fleas. By 1900, the classic model of urban plague had been established. It was a disease coming in from outside, from rodent reservoirs far from centres of dense human populations. Once it arrived, it was transported between cities by infected rats, on ships, for example, and was then transmitted to local rats and fleas, which were sources for human infection. Investigators in China and India also established plague's typical clinical features. These include high temperatures, carbuncles at the site of the initial flea bites, and painful buboes or swellings at the lymph nodes, usually in the neck, groin, or armpit, which are plague's most obvious clinical symptom. Death commonly occurs within 3 to 5 days of onset, and in the absence of appropriate treatment, between 40% and 60% of the victims die. Later researchers distinguished other manifestations of plague, including a rare and particularly severe pneumonic variety, spread directly from person to person, without buboes and some of the other symptoms. But the predominant form of plague since the 1890s has been bubonic plague. Even before the 1890s, modern epidemiologists were naturally interested in the history of the diseases they studied, and new information about plague in Asia was quickly applied to earlier epidemics where the same name had been used, and especially to European epidemics, since the epidemiologists had generally been trained there. There had been European epidemics described as pestilence in Latin or Greek between the 6th and 8th centuries AD, but little was known about them. Attention focused instead on the many plagues chronicled in more accessible languages, which occurred between the 14th and 18th centuries. They began with the Great Pestilence of 1347 to 1352, which has become known as the Black Death, a label first coined by Scandinavian chroniclers of the 16th century. And one of the last epidemics of plague was a famous outbreak in Marseille in 1720. It was possible to find contemporary references to buboes in most of them, and the presence of rats and fleas in the crowded cities they affected might reasonably be assumed. Almost immediately, however, discrepancies between modern and past plagues were identified. Not only were there scarcely any early references to fleas, or even rats in association with plague, the epidemiology of the disease also appeared to be different. In the past, cases of plague had tended to cluster in family and household concentrations, but that was not obviously so in India in the 1890s. Most striking of all, between 1347 and 1352, plague spread with lethal effect across almost the whole of Europe with a speed never witnessed in modern India or China, despite modern transport facilities. The more that was discovered about both past and more recent plagues, the more obvious the differences became. Several historians of European plagues have consequently been sceptical about their attribution to Yersinia pestis, and biologists have looked for alternatives which might have been at work alongside it, or even have been wholly responsible for the great mortalities evident in the historical record. None of these suggestions from outright plague deniers has commanded assent, however. What must now be accepted is that the modern model of plague cannot be imposed in all its essentials on the past. Most scholars familiar with the historical arguments would probably agree with the measured summary of a medical historian, Vivian Nutton. If Yersinia pestis was the biological agent of the Black Death, as is still, on balance, the most likely explanation, its behaviour then, and for centuries afterwards, differed at times considerably from what has been observed over the last century and more. The symptoms of plague are recognisably the same, but its epidemiology and demographics are clearly distinct. The disease has changed its character with place and time. In other words, a conclusion wholly consistent with modern research. Not only do pathogens mutate, albeit much more slowly in the case of a bacillus like Yersinia pestis than in the case of viruses of various kinds, but other factors determining the epidemiology of plague vary even more markedly. The modern reservoirs of the disease include a great variety of rodents, rats in Madagascar and Vietnam, gerbils in Kazakhstan, Marianese in Iran. Several species of flea can transmit it among rodents and then to humans, and some recent studies suggest that some of them may transmit it directly from one person to another. They have shown also that in Asia, Africa, and the Americas, plague is to be found in a variety of different climates and habitats. It affects different age groups in different parts of the world, and its human incidence, and therefore its demographic outcome, vary with standards of living and styles of housing, and with the behavioural responses of peoples and governments. The most important recent contributions to our knowledge of plague, however, have come from the application of modern techniques of molecular biology to DNA recoverable from human archaeological remains, in sites which can reasonably be associated with past epidemics. Since Nutton published his conclusions, several papers have appeared which make major and persuasive contributions. One of these papers, published in 2010 by an international group of scientists, used the technique of genome sequencing to trace the genealogy of Yersinia pestis found in its present locations. It concluded that the pathogen evolved in China or its vicinity more than 2,600 years ago, before producing different strains or biovars in different locations in the course of its subsequent evolution. Another paper, also in 2010, by a similar group, analysed evidence from 76 skeletons found in 5 possible plague sites in different European countries, all dating from the 14th to 17th centuries. It found evidence or one or other of 2 different strains of the bacillus in all 5 sites, which suggested that the disease might have entered Europe by 2 different routes, and it concluded that this large body of evidence demonstrated unambiguously that Yersinia pestis caused the Black Death. That conclusion has been amply confirmed by similar work in recent years. It is becoming clearer also that the different strains of Yersinia pestis found in different places can be used as markers to trace the movement of plague across space as well as time. Part of the history of plague is recoverable from the archaeological and biological record of ancient DNA. The historical record. More certain knowledge of the pathogen responsible and how it behaves tells us only a part of the history of past plagues. However, for most of the rest, historians have to rely on the written record, and that also has limitations which need to be recognised at the outset. The consistent use of the name plague for certain crowd diseases of severe form can often be supported by written descriptions of heavy mortality and distinctive symptoms, especially in the long sequence of European epidemics from the later Middle Ages onwards. Beginning with Michel de Piazza in the initial outbreak in Messina in 1347, chroniclers and physicians commented on buboes and other tokens of plague, like carbuncles, boils, pustules, and spots of various kinds, and used them along with the suddenness of death and the rapid transmission of the disease to distinguish it from other infections. An English chronicler was therefore able to separate cases of pestilence, plague, from cases of the pox, smallpox, when they coincided in an epidemic in 1369. And a few years later, a Florentine merchant made similar distinctions, stressing in his case the exceptional contagiousness of a disease which he and his contemporaries sometimes called simply the contagion. Nonetheless, there could never be absolute certainty about plague's identity. There were as many plague deniers in the past as there have been more recently, often for good, if self-interested, reasons. The first reaction of many town authorities to an epidemic was to deny that it was plague until the evidence was plain for all to discern. To do otherwise was to provoke the flight of many of the citizens and disrupt local commerce, which is why slandering a town with plague was a potent weapon for anyone disaffected. Doctors were subjected to similar pressures from patients and their families, given the social isolation that followed a plague diagnosis. Yet there was more than self-interest in the several cases of disease being described as much like the plague but not the plague, or not the plague but a disease somewhat akin to it. It was the uncertainty of contemporary medical understanding that led Ambrose Paré, a 16th-century French physician, to reach the conclusion that because plague exhibited so great variety, it was very difficult to set down anything general or certain about it. One obstacle to understanding was the absence of any clear notion, before the later 17th century, that diseases were specific entities. Despite general agreement on plague symptoms, it was thought possible for one disease to be transformed into another, so that spotted fever, typhus, might turn from a plague-like fever into the genuine article. The epidemiology of plague was as difficult to understand as its etiology. Contemporary writers from 1348 onwards tried to grapple with questions such as why plague hit some countries or cities when others escaped. There was a variety of possible answers. At the individual level, doctors in the classical medical tradition, going back to the Roman physician Galen, looked to the constitution of the victim in order to discover what predisposed him or her to infection, and found the answer in an imbalance in the humours, whose equilibrium was vital to health. When it came to explaining infected localities, the Greek physician Hippocrates had directed attention to environments, to the weather and waters, and to the modes of housing and diet prevalent in particular places. And alongside all this, there was an equally long history to concepts of contagion, which explained how plague was transmitted from person to person, through breath or touch, or by exchange of clothes and property. Although often embellished in different ways, these three approaches to disease, with their focus respectively on the individual, the environment, and modes of transmission, have been common to most cultures and civilizations susceptible to epidemics and crowd diseases. They have left ample room for argument about which of them had greatest importance, and in the case of European plagues, as we shall see later, there was often fierce controversy between those who attributed them to local environments and those who regarded contagion and transmission across space as fundamental. But the realities of epidemic situations meant that the three elements were usually combined in one mixture or other, and could reasonably be thought to have features in common. Notions of corruption and putrefaction, for example, might be used to explain the imbalances in the humours which laid some individuals open to plague, and which also might account for the poisonous miasmas in the air which spread plague in particular environments. And both kinds of pollution might cling to individuals and things, and so contribute to the contagion which spread contamination, the smell of plague, from place to place. Despite the uncertainties which gave some instability to definitions and interpretations of plague, however, most of the arguments in the past were about its nature, not about whether plague existed at all. They were part of prolonged and repeated discussions between the 14th and 18th centuries, comparing the symptoms and modes of expression of a particular epidemic disease. In that period also, there were sources independent of the narratives of chroniclers and physicians, which drove home the same message, and provided indisputable evidence of a particularly savage and rapidly lethal infection. In the 14th and 15th centuries, manorial records recording tenements left vacant testified to the impact of plague in rural areas, and from the 14th to 18th centuries there were registers of wills, lists of deaths, and bills of mortality in towns, all of them recording substantial increases in mortality for a few months in what other sources describe as years of plague. That was the historical reality of plague, and some of it was known to Europeans who encountered it later, when it had disappeared from Europe. They were able to observe it first, and almost immediately, in the Near East and North Africa in the later 18th and early 19th centuries. They then looked at it more closely in the Far East in the 1890s, and knew something about its presence earlier in 19th century China. They had little doubt that what they saw on these occasions was the old bubonic plague, from which Europe had now somehow escaped, and that the bacillus they were searching for, and ultimately isolated, should be called pestis. Plague had a continuous history. How far back that history extended before the 14th century was, and remains, much more uncertain. In the absence of independent evidence for the scale of epidemics, such as early registers of wills provide, much rests on the quality and quantity of the literary evidence alone. For the plagues of the 6th to 8th centuries, there are relatively full narratives of epidemics and descriptions of symptoms which clearly resemble those of the 14th century. They have left most historians in no doubt that the same disease was at work, and recent discoveries of ancient DNA confirm the identification. The same names, pestilence and plague, were applied to them in the Latin West, and there was a similar broad consistency in the terms used in the Syriac sources, which describe them in other parts of the Mediterranean. The evidence is much slighter for earlier epidemics, however. In the case of the most ancient plagues, like the Plague of the Philistines, mentioned in the Old Testament, or the Plague of Athens of 430 BC, described by Thucydides, one can scarcely rest any retrospective diagnosis on the continuity of the name on its own, and modern attempts to identify the pathogens responsible, even when there is some archaeological evidence, have been wholly inconclusive. It must be doubtful whether such cases have a place in the biological history of plague, and a large question mark will hover over them in this book for that reason. They are part of plague's larger history nonetheless, because the record that remains of them has had its own continuous existence over the centuries, and was brought into play and given fresh authority and resonance whenever the label plague was used. In classical and Christian Europe, and in the Muslim Middle East, the Old Testament and Thucydides influenced the ways in which plague was interpreted and described. The Bible showed that sudden mortalities had supernatural causes, and taught people to look for their origin in the workings of divine providence. Thucydides focused on how people reacted to them, and on the moral and social crises they caused. As we will hear in later chapters, his description of wholesale flight from an infected city left lawless with corpses unburied, religious ceremonies abandoned, and physicians unable to find a cure, was a model for all later accounts of plagues. From Livy talking about an epidemic in Rome in 364 BC onwards. It would be carrying scepticism to an extreme to say that literary conventions of this kind dictated what people saw, but they certainly taught people what to look for and record. There were few left alive to bury the dead, says Bede, about a pestilence in 6th century Britain, and a score of chroniclers in 1348 echo him. Grass grew in the streets, says Paul the Deacon about Rome in a plague in 680, and Samuel Pepys about London 1,000 years later in the plague of 1665. To a degree, interpretations and responses to plague were copied and taught, not reinvented and coined afresh whenever plague occurred. That may often have limited perceptions of the reality, but it was also part of a learning experience, especially when, as in Europe between the 14th and 18th centuries, plague epidemics were often repeated over a very long period. People learned how to avoid it, created ways of measuring and comparing one epidemic with another, and even developed mechanisms designed to mitigate its effects, as we shall see in Chapter 5. One of the continuities in the history of plague which justify this book was its educative function. Framing histories of disease. It will be evident that historians of disease need to consider multiple facets of the phenomena they study. The social history of medicine, as practiced since the 1960s, has been enormously fruitful in showing how diseases are in many respects social constructs. It has drawn attention to the non-biological elements which shape their impact, all of which must have their place in later chapters of this book. They include the social and physical circumstances which govern their incidence and severity on any given occasion, the political and social attitudes and structures which determine public reactions to them, and the intellectual and cultural presuppositions which shape the way in which they are interpreted. But historians must also pay attention to the biological phenomenon, and the large part that biology plays in the complex interactions of environments, people, and pathogens that create epidemics. Charles Rosenberg, one of the most
Sample complete. Ready to continue?